I watched your friend die on the island. I watched you fuck your girlfriend. I watched you go to hell.
You could have helped us, you know.
No, I couldn't. No, I couldn't.
Her face was full of a crazy joy.
That's the thing. And do you know why? Because I didn't care.
She stopped and sniffed.
Funny. I couldn't smell when I was a niffin.
But she didn't laugh.
Then I went the other way. I let myself rise and float up and out like a balloon into the outer darkness. I jostled the stars on my way up. I entered the sun, spent a week in its heart, riding it around and around and around. I was indestructible. Nothing could touch me, not even that. I went farther. Did you ever wonder, Quentin, whether the universe of Fillory is like ours, whether it goes on, and there are other stars and other worlds? There aren't. Fillory is the only one. I went out there, out past the sun and the moon, out through the last layer of stars. The stars were the only things in all my time as a Niffin that I couldn't pass through. And then, nothing. I flew and flew for days, never getting tired, never getting bored. And then I turned around and looked back, and there was Fillory. It looks hilarious from far away. You can't imagine a flat, whorled disk in a crowd of stars balanced on a tottering tower of turtles like in Dr. Seuss. It's ridiculous. A little toy land looking for all the world like a piece of spin art inside a buzzing swarm of white stars. I watched it for a long time. I didn't know if I would ever go back. It's the closest thing I ever felt to sadness.
She fell silent. The fridge buzzed. Elliot got up and shoved it. But you did go back, Quentin said.
I went back. I did whatever I wanted. Once I boiled a lake with everything in it. I chased birds and animals and burned them. Everyone was afraid of me. I was a bluebird of unhappiness. Sometimes they screamed or cried and begged me. Once,
Alice gasped suddenly as if something cold had touched her.
Oh, God, I killed a hunter.
A quick, convulsive sob gripped her, almost a cough.
I'd forgotten that till just now. He was going to kill a deer. I didn't want him to. I burned him to nothing. It took no time at all. He never saw me.
She was breathing hard, hoarsely, one hand on her chest, like she was trying not to pass out or throw up. Her gaze darted around the room. It's all right now, Alice, he said softly. It's not your fault. That seemed to revive her. Alice slapped her palms down on the table. Her expression was angry again.
It is my fault!
She shrieked at him, as if he were trying to take away her most precious possession.
I killed him! Me! I did that! No one else!
She put her head down on her arms. Her shoulders were tense. Quentin didn't know how to reach her.
I hated him, but I hated everyone, and more than anyone, I hated you, Quentin. Hate isn't like love. It doesn't end. It goes on forever. You can never get to the bottom of it, and it's so pure, so unconditional. Do you know what I see when I look at you? I see dull, stupid, ugly creatures full of emotional garbage. Your feelings are corrupt and contaminated, and half the time you don't even know what you're feeling. You're too stupid and too numb. You love and you hate and you grieve and you don't even feel it.
Quentin stayed very still. It wasn't even that she was wrong. It was true. That's what people were like. But she'd forgotten that he knew that too. and that once upon a time, that shared knowledge had been part of what brought them together. But he didn't say that. Not yet. She stopped and sat up again.
I'm having weird cravings. Mangoes. Marzipan.
She frowned. And what's it called?
Fennel. Then it goes away. It's been so long since I tasted anything.
Her voice when she said that last was the closest thing to the old Alice that he'd heard since she woke up.
I had so much power. So much power. After a while I realized I could let myself slip backward in time. It was easy. If you think about it, you're moving through time all the time, 1 second forward every second. But you don't have to. You can just let yourself stop. I could almost do it even now. It's as if you're on a rope tow up a ski slope, and you just let your mittens go slack, let the rope slide through your fingers, and you slow down and stop. There goes the present, rolling on without you. It's gone. And just like that, you're in the past. It's a wonderful feeling. But you can't change anything. You can only watch. I watched the Chatwins come to Fillory. I watched people be born and die. I saw Jane Chatwin have sex with a fawn.
She snorted with laughter. I think she was a very lonely person. Sometimes I just watched people read or sleep. It didn't matter. It was all funny. It never stopped being funny.
Once I let myself go all the way back, all the way to the beginning of Fillory, the beginning of everything, or this everything anyway, it was as far as you could go. You bumped up against it like you'd reached the end of your string. You couldn't call it a pretty sight, the dawn of creation. It was more like the corpse of whatever had come before, just a big desert and a shallow, dead-looking sea. No weather, no wind, just cold. The sun didn't move. The sunlight was unpleasant, like an old fluorescent light that a bunch of flies had died in. Looking back now, I think the sun and moon must have collided and melted together into one single deformed heavenly body. I watched the sea for a long time. You wouldn't think a body of water that big could be so still. Finally, a big old tigress came loping down to the water. Her ears were notched, and she'd lost an eye, and it had healed shut. You could see her padding along from a mile away. I thought she must be a goddess. She came down to the edge of the water. She looked at her reflection for a bit. Then she went trotting into the water, up to her shoulders. She stopped then and shuddered and sneezed once. Obviously it was distasteful to her, but she did it anyway. She seemed very brave to me. She kept on going until she was totally submerged. And then nothing. She had drowned herself. I saw her body float up to the surface, on its side, slowly turning in place in the slack tide. And then it sank again for good. For a long time after that, nothing happened. Then the water kind of gathered itself into a wave, and the wave threw up two big curly shells on the shore. They lay next to each other for a while, and then another wave came and left behind it a sheet of foam. The sand underneath them kind of stirred and shook itself, and it sat up, and that was Ember. The foam was his wool. The shells were his horns. Ember went trotting down the beach until he found a couple more curly shells, and he nudged them around for a bit till they were next to each other,
and then stood next to them so that his shadow fell over them, and then the shadow stood up, and that was Umber. They nodded to each other and then went trotting together up into the sky. They took turns licking at the big moon sun in the sky until it split into two things again, and then Ember butted the sun in one direction and got it moving, and Umber butted the moon, and the whole business started again. And that was the beginning of Fillory. But mostly I didn't give a shit about shit like that. Do you know what my favorite parts of the past were? I liked to watch myself sleep with Penny because it hurt you. And most of all, I liked to watch myself burn. I liked to go back to when I died and hide in the walls and watch it happen over and over again. "Could you see the future?" Elliot asked.
"No,"
she said in the same lightsome, detached tone. It was all the same to her. Something to do with timelines and information flow, I think.
"Maybe it's just as well," Quentin said.
"If I could have, I sure as shit wouldn't have come back here."
"That's what I meant."
"At first I couldn't even get to Earth, but something changed. The barrier softened, and I could. I found out by accident. I liked mirrors. I liked looking at myself without flesh. And then one day I touched one and went through into a weird space inside it. It was in between, like the Netherlands. Mirrors within mirrors took you farther down, deeper and deeper, and at some point they became mixed up with the mirror spaces of other worlds. I spent months in there. It was cold and empty, or almost. I met a lost bird once, fluttering around trying to get out. When I came back up, it was into this world, not Fillory. I didn't mind. Breakbills was interesting. A lot of magic there, and a lot of mirrors. It had a very complex mirror space. I thought I might find my brother there, but I didn't. But I found you, Quentin. You were a scab I wanted to keep picking. You hurt me even then, and pain was something I enjoyed. And the people were interesting. I could tell Plum was connected to Fillory, though I'm still not quite sure how. I was so sure you were going to fuck her."
"Why does literally everybody think that?" Plum muttered.
"And then you tried to make a land."
She was speechless with silent laughter for a few seconds.
"Oh, my God, it's so pathetic. You, Quentin, you could never make anything. Don't you see? How could somebody like you create something that was alive? You're a hollow man. There's nothing inside you. All you could make was that cold, dead mirror house.
And do you know why?
Because all you ever do is what you think people expect you to do, and then you feel sorry for yourself when they hate you."
"I've changed a lot, Alice," Quentin said. "Maybe that was true once, I don't know, but I've changed a lot in 7 years."
"No, you haven't."
"Think about this. Could the Quentin you knew have made you human again?" Alice was silent for a few seconds, for the first time, long enough that Plum jumped in.
"Why are you telling us all this anyway?" Plum appeared to have had enough of Alice. "I mean, it's fascinating and all, but it's sort of not what we expected."
"I am telling you this," Alice hissed, "so that he knows what he did."
She was answering Plum, but she stared at Quentin. "Tell me what I did." Quentin stared back at her. Her eyes had changed. They weren't quite the same eyes she'd had before. "I want to know."
"Then listen. You robbed me!"
She spat it. But she was already losing steam. She didn't even have the energy to be angry anymore.
I was perfect. I was immortal. I was happy. You took all that away from me.
Did you expect me to be grateful? Did you? I didn't want to be human again, but you dragged me back into this body.
She held up her hands like they were low-grade meat, a butcher's discards.
I lost everything. Twice. The first time I gave it up, but the second time you stole it.
Chapter 26. Another tremor. It shook Umber awake. He opened his eyes.
My heart, he whispered.
But when Janet looked away from the sunset, the sunfall, the god was already gone. Lots to do. World ending, can't hang around. He bounced back pretty fast from his beating, she would give him that. It crossed her mind that maybe he'd been faking. Maybe he'd gone down easy, taken a dive. It would have been like him. Either way, she was kind of relieved Umber was gone. She didn't especially want to spend the end of the world with him. Meanwhile, the action on the edge of the world was deeply, sublimely awful. The sun was squashing there like a rotten pumpkin. It hadn't just grazed the rim of Fillory. It was definitively, agonizingly bottoming out there, grinding itself flat, spending its remaining thermal and kinetic energy on destroying itself and throwing stupendous curling gouts and ferns of fire in the air and erecting a vast pillar of steam reaching up to the sky. She'd never even seen the edge of the world. The others had, but now she never would. Or even if she did, it wouldn't be the same. Now it would have a big cigarette burn on it. Janet looked over her shoulder at the other horizon and saw that the moon was rising, as per usual. Good old moon. It must orbit twice as fast as the sun, she thought, to get in its eclipse at noon and then get back around again to rise in the evening. Or no, it would have to go even faster than that. Variable speed? Multiple moons? She started trying to figure it out and then stopped. What did it even matter now?
We shouldn't be here, Poppy said. We should be back at the castle.
What does it even matter? She said, out loud this time. She wished Elliot were here, or Quentin. Josh and Poppy were all right, but come on, they were short-timers, rookies. She would have liked the company of another old schooler like herself, even Julia. This means we're the last, she said. The last kings and queens of Fillory ever. I suppose that's a claim to fame.
It's not over yet. We should go back to Whitespire. The people need us.
That's the spirit. Go, Janet said. You're right. Take care of them. I'll catch up. I'm going to stay here for a bit.
She couldn't have said why, but being here felt right. The weird, evenly spaced hills, lit up by the flickering, flaring light from the dying sun, casting long shadows back and away. She felt calm here. They would be fine back at Whitespire. What on earth would her presence add? She would sit her final vigil here, in the hills of the Chankly Boar. Josh started to say something, but Poppy touched his arm, and he shut up. She got it. They were out of their depth. In a quiet, business-like way, Josh began the portal ritual.
I'll leave it open after, he said.
Yeah.
When it gets too bad, he said, we'll come back for you, with the button.
Yeah.
I'll be here. Then they were gone. Overhead, the sky was a deepening blue, and with the green of the hills and the gray of the mountains and the flaming red-orange of the horizon, it was a pretty striking scene. Too bad she didn't have a camera, or an easel, or a powerfully developed aesthetic sensibility. Janet wasn't much for rapt contemplation. She sat down on the chilly grass with her back to the hard, lumpy oak at the summit of the hill. Maybe she should be wearing sunglasses, like those people who went out to the desert to watch the early atomic tests. Janet shivered. It seemed wrong that, of them all, she was the one to bear witness to this. Her, the cynical one. No shits or fucks given. Well, maybe it's better this way. Better than somebody with a lot of big, weepy feelings. Quentin would be a Trevi-fucking fountain of tears by this point. Somebody or something west of her winded a great deep horn, a massive, sustained brass pedal note. There were a few seconds of silence, then it was answered from off to the south by a piercing silver trumpet tone, the same note a fistful of octaves higher. Then six or seven notes followed in unison from all points of the compass, even out to sea, shifting between major harmonies and clashing tritones. Who the fuck is playing that shit? Janet thought. How do they even know what notes to play? Probably it was written somewhere. Probably there's always been a big alpenhorn somewhere under glass, with a sign that says, "In case of Ragnarok, break glass and play an E-flat." Where's my horn? It would have been nice to at least have a horn, she thought, allowing herself some bitterness, some self-pity. Because if not now, then when? It would have given her something to do. As one, all around her, the clock trees began to toll. She didn't know they could. She got to her feet. This would never do. She was moping, and it wouldn't do. She needed to get involved, find out what was happening. She stood up, and on cue the grass in front of her practically exploded as a hippogriff slammed down onto it, landing at speed and skidding halfway down the slope on its talons and hooves and ripping up half the hillside with it. It gathered itself and trotted back up the slope to her. It had come to find her.
"Your Highness, Queen Janet, ruler of Fillory, this hippogriff awaits your pleasure."
Respect. From a hippogriff. It really was the end of the world. She strode to him, set a foot on its thigh, and swung her leg over its broad, tawny, close-furred back. It helped that the slope of the hill was on her side. She realized she knew this one. It had a red crest. She'd ridden it to the northern marsh before. "Let us fly, then, you and I, brave beast," she said. "Though it be for the last time on the last day." Whatever, she told herself. Don't judge. If there was ever a time for this kind of talk, this was it. She wasn't sure if it was tears or the wind or both, but her eyes were streaming as they took to the sky, and she had to blot them with her sleeve. Janet gave the hippogriff its head, and it spiraled up over the chankly boar. Was it a tidal boar? No, that was something else, she was almost sure, and turned south. The light was indescribably weird, dying, flickering sunlight from the west, on her right, and on her left the light of the rising moon, the two meeting and mingling into a silver-gold radiance unlike anything she'd ever seen. "Higher, higher," she called, and the hippogriff obeyed. As it did, Janet laid a few spells on herself, specifically on her eyes, distance, focus, resolution, night vision. If she was going to witness this, she wanted to see everything, to spare herself nothing. Ears, too, she jacked up her hearing. She would be the recording angel this night. The effect was disconcerting. Data came flooding in, more than her brain was really meant to process, and she literally jerked her head back as her vision exploded with detail. But she had to see it all. It was on her now, no one else. Fillory seethed with motion. It was a restless night for the magic land, and everybody was out on the town. Even the trees were moving. The huge inky mass of the darkling woods to the west was no longer keeping to its customary outline. The trees, or the animate ones anyway, had pulled up their roots and were marching east in the direction of Castle Whitespire, cracking their gnarly knuckles as if to say, "Oh yeah, at last, we're going to get this done." It must have some ancient beef with the Queenswood, she thought, and now they were going to throw down.
The trees left behind them a 5 o'clock shadow of regular, inanimate trees, a skeleton crew where the original forest was. Yup, the Queenswood was in turn adopting a defensive crouch, elongating itself into a protective crescent around the borders of Whitespire. Moving from the south to intercept the Darklings, presumably it was what she would have done, were the smaller but no less game trees of Corian's land, bolstered by the plucky little apple and pear trees of the southern orchard. Fateful, like Birnam Wood to Dunsinane. It's so Macbeth, or Hamlet, I forget which. Whitespire itself was lit up, every window. It looked like a Manhattan skyscraper full of high-powered lawyers pulling an all-nighter. The courtyard was full of men armoring up. Who were they going to fight? They must have no idea what was going on. Or maybe it was her, Janet, who was out of the loop. They'd probably read a bunch of prophecies. It's not like she had a fucking horn, was it? Her eyes were two invisible searchlights, pitilessly clear, and she swept their twin beams over the eerily lit, grassy hills of Fillory. It wasn't just the trees that were moving. Animals were running below her, too, and galloping and scampering and lumbering and fluttering. Deer, horses, bears, birds, bats, smaller things that might have been foxes or weasels or something. Wolves and big cats coursed along side by side. My, but this was a biodiverse nation she presided over, at least for, oh, the next couple of hours, anyway. All of them were flowing in vast numbers on various vectors in the direction of Castle Whitespire. Or, whoops, her eyes cut over. Not all. Some of them were already there. More animals were already formed up around Whitespire to meet them. The penny dropped. God, all the buried tensions of this gorgeous, fucked-up place were just spilling over tonight. Those must be the talking animals at Whitespire, and the regular animals were marching to war against them. She knew they'd always avoided each other, but she never realized that they actually loathed each other. They must have been planning for this night for centuries. The non-speaking animals came on in a massed rabble. The talking ones stood stock still in neat squares in the fields outside Whitespire, trampling the crops the way crops had been trampled by every army since the beginning of time. It was a black mass, a night with no rules. In the vanguard for the non-speakings were a few of the very fastest beasts, bounding singly and in pairs over the low stone walls, clearing them by ridiculous margins that bordered on the show-offy, cheetahs and antelopes ignoring each other for once, or maybe they were gazelles, plus a couple of lions and wild horses and some newy-looking motherfuckers that might have been wildebeests. Who knew those bastards could run like that? It was pretty awesome, actually. Behind them, just ahead of the second wave, came a pack of very large, ambitious, energetic dogs. They crashed straight into the impeccably ruled lines of the talking animals, a few of them meeting head-to-head with a brain-jellying smack that made you want to cringe and maybe vomit, even from this distance. It made it all 10 times realer, that horrible sound, more even than the sun. It was the sound of death, the ultimate irreversible. This was really happening, and nothing would ever be the same. Though more often the animals went in tearing and scrapping, and when they did they went for their opposite numbers, head to head, speaking versus non-speaking. The cats went down immediately, snarling and pawing at each other in a haze of dust. You didn't see any dog-on-cat action, or not yet. The talking animals were calling out in the fray just the way human soldiers would. To me! To me! On my right! The right flank! Right flank! Hold, damn you! Hold the line! Hold! Hold! It was a pretty even matchup. The talking animals were smarter and more organized, and they were, on average, a bit bigger than the dumb kind. But the dumb animals had the numbers. Janet found herself rooting for the talkers instinctively, but then asking herself why. Were they morally better than the dumb ones? Did they deserve to win? Maybe she was just prejudiced. The talking ones at least got to talk. Maybe she should give the dumb ones this much, a victory in the last battle, the one that didn't count for anything. Janet thought of the sloths. Probably there was a contingent of sloths, like 50 miles from here, a whole fighting regiment of them, and they wouldn't get here for a month, and by then it would all be over. Or maybe the sloths didn't care enough to fight at all? Good God! Was that Humbledrum the bear laying about him in the press? Slow to anger, that one, but my God, what a monster! He had a steel collar protecting his neck, and he was in full-on berserker mode, no doubt fueled by a barrel or two of schnapps. She hoped he survived. But then again, none of them were going to survive, were they? So maybe it was better if he died like this, in the thick of it, rather than watching the ruins of his world break apart under his feet. The hippogriff soared on, and Janet lost sight of Humbledrum in the chaos and the gloom. She would never know. She was dimly aware that there was fighting in the air around her now, too, birds having at it, complex dogfights, sprays of blood and feathers. Once in a while a pair would lock together and go twirling down out of the sky, neither one willing to release the other to save itself. Janet wondered if they'd break apart before they hit the ground, but she could never follow a pair long enough to see. Men were fighting now, too, around the castle. She squinted at them, focusing her magically augmented telescopic vision. Who were they going to fight? Lorians? Monkeys? No, just those beast people, half-animal, half-human, the ones Ember's tomb had been full of, and a unit of dark elves in shiny black chitinous-looking armor. Where had they been all this time? Josh and Poppy were playing defense, Josh on the battlements, Poppy flying over the press like a leggy Valkyrie, taking some incoming fire in the form of spears and arrows that she was having trouble managing. There, she was backing off, floating higher, out of range. She'd be all right. She'd better. She and Josh were her ticket out of this shit show. The last chopper out of Magic Saigon. Janet swept her gaze across the landscape, searching out more bad news. It was all very voyeuristic, like porn. More! More apocalypse! And there was more. Loads more. The centaurs were coming thundering down from the retreat where they hung out. Strict formation for these guys. They'd probably been drilling for this shit for generations. They mixed into the fray. They mostly fought two-handed, heavy short swords in both hands, or with bow and arrow. And holy shit, they were going after the talking animals? There, that guy lopped the head clean off what had clearly till moments ago been a talking deer. A spray of blood mounted up over the heads of the struggling fighters. Then it weakened and subsided. Those fucking dicks! Nobody liked them, and now she knew why. They were probably total Nazis. Figured if they could take out the other sentient beings, they could run everything according to their weird fascist philosophy. Even Janet couldn't sit back for this. She sent a couple of bolts of lightning into their column and got back a volley of arrows that the hippogriff evasively maneuvered around, after which it cocked its head back at her, just for an instant, to say with its furious yellow eye, "WTF! I did not sign on for this!" "Sorry," Janet said, and patted its neck. "I just can't stand those guys." For a minute it looked like the centaurs were going to make the difference, but then, boom, a spearhead of unicorns rammed into the side of their formation. Jesus! Janet had to turn away. You only had to see a unicorn lay open the side of a centaur once, the ribcage flashing white when the ripped skin flopped down, to swear a mighty oath never to fuck with or even look at another unicorn again. "I'm putting down the hearts and fluffy clouds and backing away slowly. Don't want any trouble here. You can have all the rainbows." It was, viewed from a certain detached, clinical angle, like Fillory was playing chess with itself. A band of minotaurs straggled up, panting, having been outdistanced by the centaurs, but plainly on their side. But just as they did, flocks of griffins and pegasi began crisscrossing the battle space from above, kicking and raking and tearing. Actually, the pegasi appeared to be worth fuck all from an offensive perspective. Their little hooves were too light and delicate to do much damage to anybody, and they were too fussy to beat anybody with their wings the way a swan might. But still, total respect to them for showing up. And what did it matter, because the Griffins were cleaning house? Jesus, those guys were like flying tanks, beak and claws, built for war. "Hey," Janet said to the hippogriff, "you want to get in on this? You want to fight?" But the beast shook its head. Ferrying Queen Janet around was enough for it. Its ambitions went no further, which she totally got. This would be its war effort. "What's your name?"
"Winterwing,"
it squawked back at her. She patted its neck again. "Well flown, Winterwing, well flown. Fillory is grateful to you this night. Take us higher now." No part of Fillory was untouched by the conflict. Here and there along the rivers and streams, the nymphs had surfaced, the water around them reflecting the weird, mingled light, though they only watched for now. Janet didn't imagine they'd be drawn into a fight unless their interests were directly threatened. Some of the dryads took the same tack, standing by their trees, leaning against them or twirling their staves the way a cop would twirl a nightstick. God, she'd totally forgotten about the forests. They were almost into it now, a grove of the forwardmost elms and birch from Corian's land. Corian, who he? Another thing she'd never know. Had already jumped a big outriding oak from the darkling woods. The oak was a monster, and it had uprooted a couple of the lighter trees and was waving them over its head like a kraken, but it was being overrun. A few of its branches were cracked off already, and the leaves were flying. Trees were fucking mental in a fight, it turned out. Janet looked up to see the moon tumbling overhead. It was still up there, but way off course, spinning slowly end over end, aimless, lost in space. For some reason, that was what did it. Janet threw her arms around the hippogriff's neck. She sobbed into its soft feathers and got snot on them, too. Whatever, it probably had bird mites. This was it, she thought. This was my best thing. My best thing. I thought I would always have it, but I was wrong. The hippogriff's neck was stiff and proud against her face. It didn't turn to look at her. Maybe it wasn't very comfortable with displays of emotion. Well, tough. Since her nights in the desert, Janet was all about being in touch with her emotions. Janet heard and felt a deep boom, and she looked up mid-weep. Half the mountains in the northern barrier range had just erupted, blown their tops off like ripe pimples. She hadn't even known they were volcanic, but now they were lobbing big seminal gobbets of lava all over their lower slopes, like a drunk prom queen puking on her dress. Shit was getting geological, yo. Fillory was bleeding its hot arterial blood. She made a visual survey of the coast. Broken Bay was overflowing its banks, drowning the lower reaches of the Chankly Bore in seawater. Some of the hills were gone. You could just see the trees poking up out of the water. Farther out to sea, she thought she saw a couple of sentient boats trying to ride out the tempest. To the south, monstrous dunes from the deep desert were slamming into the headwall of the Copper Mountains and threatening to bury the lush southern plains in sand. No, keep out! She wanted to stretch out her hands and push the desert back, stick her finger in the dike. Probably the Foremost's gang were shivering down in their ice caves. Fillory was under siege, and the boundaries were failing everywhere. The center cannot hold, and the edges are in pretty fucking dire shape, too. A crack opened, zigging across two open fields, glowing hot and red, the grass crisping up at the lip. She wanted to throw her arms around Fillory, hug it, and squash it back together. But she couldn't. Nobody could. Now something was harrying the darkling woods in the rear, and Janet focused in on Jane Chatwin, come on down! The former watcher woman looked pissed off, gray hair loose and flying, and whenever she pointed her finger at an ambulatory tree, it stopped. Its shoulders sort of sank, and it rooted itself back down to the ground again.
Looks like she was planning to ride this bomb down like Slim Pickens. All the heavy hitters were checking in now. Up in the barrier range, the giants, for lack of anybody their own size to pick on, and because they knew they were all going to die anyway, were fighting each other, brawling and weeping huge tears as they did so. Over by White Spire, the battle lines parted to make way for a large, flightless bird, proceeding in a stately fashion between the two sides of the battle of the animals, and that could only be the great bird of peace, one of the unique beasts. It had the gait of a cassowary, or what Janet imagined the gait of a cassowary to be, lifting its feet carefully with its inverted knees and swaying its head backward with every step. When it reached the center of the field, it paused, gazing around it calmly, as if to say, "Now then, my lovelies, isn't it time to put an end to this foolishness? Do you not feel the love in my heart and in your own?" Then two big cats, a panther and a leopard, swarmed it, and it went down without even a squawk. It might have had love in its heart, Janet thought, but it also had a hell of a lot of blood. Along with her regular serving of horror, Janet felt an extra cold chill. Whatever magic gave the unique beasts their mandate, that was the foundation of Fillory, the rebar in the cement. Even the deeper magic wasn't cutting it tonight. If that was failing, then all bets were really off. The northern swamp was disgorging its beasts, some real sick fucks, chief among them that snapping turtle, the prince of the mud, and some huge wet lizard thing banded in yellow and black, flat and wide and squashed-looking, a grotendous big salamander. Even as she watched, it paused, trying to focus its wide-set eyes on something tiny, or relatively tiny, directly in front of it. It was a white stag. It was the questing beast, standing before it, alone and unafraid. "Oh, thank God," she thought. She couldn't hear, but as she watched, it said something. It said it again, and then a third time, like someone trying to strike fire from a wet matchbook. The salamander closed its huge eyes and settled down on its belly. It was dead. The questing beast had wished it dead. It had taken three tries, though, and apparently even the questing beast only got three. It had saved its wishes all those years, all those centuries, and now they were gone. It seemed to shrug, if a stag can shrug, and then the snapping turtle snapped, and the beautiful beast's white legs were sticking out of its mouth for a second, and then it was gone. "That seems unfair," Janet thought. "A bad trade. The questing beast for some big salamander I never even heard of before. A rook for a knight." She checked back in on the sun, still boiling and thrashing on the horizon, spreading out laterally like dropped ice cream melting on a hot sidewalk. Probably it would take like a million years or some other cosmic span of time to expend all its energy and die. She checked back in on Josh and Poppy. Poppy was taking a break on top of one of White Spire's walls, which were holding pretty well so far. Janet supposed that if things got bad, they'd have to open the gates and retreat into the bailey, but it hadn't come to that yet. She missed Josh for a minute, till she found him down on the battlefield itself. He was in magic armor, sealed up tight. She was amazed he could even breathe in there, clumping around the field with a mace, always the fat man's weapon of choice for some reason, whacking at whatever got in range. An angry elephant put its foot on him, and Janet's breath caught in her throat, but Josh's armor held. In fact, it was so smooth and frictionless that he squirted out from under the elephant's foot like a pumpkin seed and flew 20 yards. Josh picked himself up. He'd dropped his mace, but he was completely invulnerable anyway. Janet wondered what he thought he was doing, if hitting some wildebeests or whatever with a stick was making him feel better. "Let them join the fray," she thought. "Let them have their fun." She just hoped the baby was safe. And at that moment, out of nowhere, Janet knew that she herself would never have children. Probably she'd known it for a while, but it was the first time she'd admitted it to herself. Let others breed. Let them, and God be with them. She would be the witness. She was tough enough to see everything break and not break herself. They also serve who fly around on hippogriffs and watch. There was a lot to watch. It was all on now. Fillory had gone all in, the whole fucking pub quiz. Probably even the bugs were fighting each other. Where were the dwarfs, she wondered. Sitting it out underground? A tall and rather august man in a tuxedo had joined the fray, fighting bare-handed, and Janet thought she recognized him from Quentin's stories about the edge of the world. The battle was dissolving into frantic scrums featuring all kinds of weird shit she'd never even seen before. A burning suit of armor, a man who seemed to be woven out of rope, another who was just built out of pebbles. To the south, a towering dune had finally crested the Copper Mountains, and surfing on it like a mad thing was a tremendous clipper ship crewed by rabbits? For real? Was that something from the books? It had been so long. They came ripping down the steep slopes, heeled over. It should have been exciting. Bunnies! A magic clipper ship that goes on land! But all it provoked in Janet was exhaustion. What next? Sir Hotspots? Fuck all this, she said, and she squeezed her eyes shut for a minute. There was no end to Fillory, no end to the beauty and strangeness, except that there was, and this was it. She had to force herself to let go of it, and it felt like tearing off a piece of her own flesh. It was ending too soon, the way everything did. Everything except Ebola viruses and really bad people like psychopaths. Those things never ended. How was that fair? Fuck it, it was stupid. Theories about life were always bullshit. The chaos itself was momentarily, unfairly beautiful. The thrashing sun, the spinning, looping moon, Fillory half-light and half-shadow, dotted with flashes of fire, lava, and flame, and magical strikes from magical beings, ignorant armies clashing by night. And way off in the distance, but still visible to her far-sighted eyes, came the glow of the clock barons going up in flames and fireworks all at once. So at least she'd seen that after all. Then Janet saw maybe the most flat-out marvelous thing she had ever seen or ever would see in her life. Overhead, a constellation in the shape of a lanky, loose-jointed person detached itself from the night sky, hung by one stellar hand for a second, and then dropped, falling for a long minute and sending up a shower of sparks when it hit on its back, its component orbs embedding themselves in the turf of a meadow. It was immediately engaged there by the only other two-dimensional combatant on the field, the Chalk Man, who had recovered his spirits and repaired his staff. Puffs of limestone flew, and motes of light. It's like revelation, she thought. It's revelation, and I'm the Scarlet Woman. Winterwing, Janet said. Back to Whitespire. It's time. The hippogriff set them down on top of the broad wall of Whitespire, which looked like it was going to finally see the battle it was presumably built to withstand, because the humans and the talking animals were giving ground now, falling back toward the great gates, which even Janet had never seen opened. She dismounted and walked over to where Poppy stood. Neither of them said anything. The last queens of Fillory. An almost infrasonic bass rumble had been building for a while down beneath the general din, and now it rose into the realm of the audible, and they could feel it, too. The fighters on the battlefield lost some of their interest in fighting and looked around for the source. Then it became really obvious, because the ground in front of the castle began to hump up, and anybody who was caught out in the open on the hump began to run full out, and just in time, too. The ground at the top of the hump broke open, and a spray of something weird and alien erupted out of it. Roots, Janet realized. It was a spreading crown of enormous pale roots, cracking and writhing, and at the center of it stood
Julia?
8 feet tall, and beautiful and glowing with her own magnificent radiance.
Look, Janet said, it's the Lorax.
A foolhardy panther sprang at her, and Julia smote it, there was no other word for it, out of the air, with her staff, one-handed, and sent it spinning off and up into the darkness.
Enough, she said.
Her voice must have been audible across the entire dying land. She was the brightest thing in Fillory at that moment.
It is time.
That word, time, echoed from coast to coast. Everyone on the battlefield, beasts and humans and whatever else, stood still. Julia commanded bipartisan support. She walked toward Janet and Poppy. As she walked, one of the roots extended and flattened itself and made a bridge to the parapet where they stood. Another root scooped up Josh from where he'd been sitting, exhausted, on the ground in front of the gates, and set him down next to them. "Insert joke here," Julia said in something like her normal, non-amplified, pre-divine voice, "about how I leave you alone for 5 minutes and all of Fillory goes to shit." Janet didn't know what to say. She had nothing left. She embraced Julia. It was a bit awkward, what with her being so huge and all, Janet more or less had to throw her arms around Julia's waist, but it felt wonderful. Her robes were the softest thing ever. Janet thought it might be beneath Julia's dignity to be hugged by a mortal, but she allowed it.
"Queens of Fillory," Julia said, "and King of Fillory, this is it. It is time to go."
"Where are we going?"
It was Josh who asked, in the voice of a lost child.
"Can you take us to the far side of the world?"
Julia shook her head no.
"The far side is ending, too. We are cooling the sun and stilling the waters. We are rolling up the meadows and pulling down the stars."
"Then where are we going?" he asked again.
"I don't know," Julia said. "But you can't stay here."
She held out her hands to them. Janet got it. They had to be touching each other for the enchantment to work. Poppy took Janet's hand on one side, and Julia, her fingers felt big and tingly, took the other. Janet bent her head and let herself cry. Her face streamed with tears. It wasn't going to kill her, she thought. She would live. Of course she would. She didn't have a scratch on her, for Christ's sake. Everything was going to be fine. It was just that she would never have a home again.
Chapter 27 "I'm sorry," Quentin said when Alice had finished.
"No, you're not. So don't keep saying it."
"I'm not sorry I brought you back. I'm sorry it all happened. I wish it hadn't been you. But no one else had the courage and the selflessness and the cleverness to do what you did."
"Fuck your courage and whatever else. I'm glad I did it. I'm just sorry you ruined it."
Alice continued to regard him with a contempt as inhuman as a human being could make it. "It's hard to come back. I get that. I didn't understand how hard it would be," Quentin soldiered on under withering fire. "It's hard to be human, but there's more to it than that. You knew that before. You don't remember it yet, but it'll come back to you." Quentin didn't know if it would or not, but he wasn't about to give ground now. He sensed that if he even flinched, she would take that as proof that she was right about everything. And she wasn't right.
Was she?
Elliot cleared his throat tactfully.
"There's no very good time to say this," he said, "but I have to leave."
He clapped his hands on his knees. "The end of the world is coming, and I should really be there for that." "Sure," Quentin said. "Okay."
Probably I should try to stop it. Probably I shouldn't have stayed this long.
I know. You should go.
He was being uncharacteristically hesitant. Quentin made him promise to come back as soon as he could and to give his love to Josh and Poppy.
And, oh my God, they're married? You didn't tell me that. Amazing. And pregnant?
Good for them. Okay. Now really, get out of here.
I'll just get my things.
I understand. Actually, I haven't got any things.
Having gone through the formalities, Elliot still couldn't bring himself to leave. He, of all people, was struggling to find the words to say something. He cleared his throat again.
"Will you come with me?"
he blurted it out. "If anybody can figure this out, it's you. Or Julia, but Julia isn't taking my calls.
We need you, Quentin. Come back."
To Fillory.
It hadn't even crossed his mind.
"But you know I can't go back. I can't leave Alice now, and Ember would never let me in anyway."
"I've been thinking about that second part. I told you how the Lorians invaded us, even though they aren't supposed to be able to, and then Alice found a way to get here through the mirrors. I'm starting to think that Fillory is getting a bit porous in her old age. Border security isn't what it used to be. If there was ever a moment to get you through, it's now."
There was a time when Quentin would have seized on that possibility like a drowning man. Now it gave him a pang, the dull ache of an old wound, but that was all. That time had passed. He shook his head.
"I can't, Elliot. Not now. I'm needed here."
Alice snorted at the notion that anybody anywhere might need Quentin.
"I was afraid of that," Elliot said.
"Well, look, just come with me as far as the Netherlands. That's all I ask. For all I know, there's a smoking crater where the Fillory fountain was. I don't want to face that alone."
"Oh," Plum said. Her eyes went round. "I want to go to the Netherlands."
"Netherlands," Elliot said, suddenly peevish, "and it's not a field trip for interns." They were interrupted by something scratching at the front door. The room fell silent. They weren't expecting visitors. Nobody knew they were here, or nobody should have. Quentin put a finger to his lips. More scratching. It stopped and then started again. He got up and walked as quietly as he could over to the door and peered through the spy hole. Empty street. There was nobody there. He looked at the others. Elliot shrugged. He cracked the door a few inches, keeping the chain on, and something small and frantic burst in past him, and he reeled back a step. It was the blackbird. It flapped crazily around the room for 30 long seconds with that special horror that birds have of being indoors before it settled on the Sputnik chandelier. Even then, its gaze darted everywhere constantly, like it was expecting danger from any and all directions. It looked different, thinner and more bedraggled. It was missing some feathers, and the ones it still had had lost their gloss.
"Do not kill me," it said.
Plum and Elliot were on their feet. Only Alice hadn't moved.
"What are you doing here?" Quentin said. "Are you alone?"
"I am alone."
"Why should we believe you?" Plum said. "You fucking asshole. You betrayed us, and you probably murdered Pushkar. He had a family, you know. Quentin, should we kill it?"
"Maybe. Not yet." If this was a trap or a feint or a diversion, it was a weird one, if only because he figured the bird for a physical coward. It wasn't like it to lead from the front.
"Plum, watch it. I'm going to look around for anybody else."
But there was no one else. Not in front, or in back, or on the roof, or in any immediately adjacent planes of existence. Not that he could detect. Maybe it really was alone.
"I take it this is that bird," Elliot said. "The one who hired you?"
"It's that bird. What are you doing here?"
"I have no more money," it said. "I tried to hire more magicians, but without Lionel, it went poorly."
"No money, no magicians," Quentin said. "Those are the breaks. I think you should leave now.
I did not want Lionel to kill Pushkar. I did not tell him to. I don't know why he did. I was afraid of him.